Today, my guest is a neuroscientist and founder of the company Menzi. She is a professor at Stanford University, and her latest book, Impossible to Ignore, has been selected as one of the top books on persuasion. And in this episode, we're going to discuss attention span, brain stimulation, and how to deliver a memorable message. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, Dr. Carmen Simon. Dr. Carmen, how are you?
Good. It's good to be here, and welcome everyone.
One of the things that I think I heard you saying in one of your presentations is that memory is the root of all business success. Is that really the case?
Yes, that is the case. And I know it's an extreme statement. Anytime you use words like always, never, all, you have to be prepared to back it up. I say all business success simply because if you consider the business that you're in, regardless of the field, your customers make decisions in your favor based on what they remember, not on what they forget. So you are going to be successful in business to the extent that people remember you, always.
Okay, so before we move forward, I think it's very important that you explain to us the difference between neuroscience and cognitive psychology.
Yeah, neuroscience is the field that studies the structure and function of your brain. And with improved technology these days, we don't have to wait for people to die or have accidents in order for us to understand what does what in your brain. Do we know everything about the brain? Definitely not. But we have learned so much. In the past few decades, we have discovered more than an entire mankind combined where the brain is concerned. We used to know only 30 regions in the brain. Now we know more than 200. So where the structure and function of the brain are concerned, we have made great advancements. Cognitive psychology is a field that has to do with mental functions such as attention, memories, decision-making, creativity, problem-solving. All of those are cognitive functions. And when you combine the two fields, neuroscience and cognitive psychology, now you have a new field emerging, which is cognitive neuroscience, which is my background, which means that we understand a lot more at a molecular level how attention takes place in the brain, how memories are formed, and most often not, how decisions are made, and in general, how those mental and cognitive functions are carried through.
So at one point, did you decide to use your background and apply to business and helping business as well?
I kept noticing how quickly we forget business content. And I became humbled because I used to work for a corporation in the R&D department. And we would be witnessing all sorts of vendors pitching, coming to us to pitch their products and various services. And after two or three days, when we would reflect on the presentations that we would hear, we wouldn't really know who said what. And quite often, not only do we forget most of what we were exposed to, but we kept giving credit to the wrong source. So in other words, if you were company A presenting on products XYZ, and then company B would come in and present similar content. After a while, if they didn't have a distinguishing factor about their presentation, something that talked about the 80 degrees Celsius weather or something unusual like that, then after a while, we wouldn't really know who said what message. And when the brain doesn't know, it tends to give credit to the more familiar source. So there are times when you end up giving somebody else's content, and that hurts.
So outside your book and the workshop, do you work one-on-one with clients as well?
We do. Our business is based on several branches. One is teaching brain science workshops to various corporations. And those workshops are based around sharing evidence based guidelines on what makes content memorable and how that content then influences decisions. Another branch is designing people's content from a brain science angle. So we combine brain science plus aesthetics. And another branch is based on a lot of public speaking engagements or keynotes. And yet another is the one that you just mentioned, which is consulting.
What are some of the most common mistakes you see?
Where business content is concerned, I see quite a few, especially where memory is concerned, which is my specialty. First of all, I'm noticing that quite a lot of business people aspire at being memorable, but very few really know what they want to be memorable for. Like, for example, I was listening to this one executive. He was getting ready to go on stage and talk to a few hundred salespeople in his organization. And I was asking him, what would you like people to remember after they listen to you? And he said 4 points. And he listed what those 4 points were. So first of all, I was impressed that he even had that clarity, because most people don't. So he had the clarity of his message, which is wonderful. And then I asked him, are those 4 points reflected in your presentation? And he said, no. So imagine how difficult it is then if what you have in mind is not really reflected in something that somebody else has created for you. And because the audience's brains are not going to make that leap in integrating something that they hear you say and something that they see behind you. So make sure that when you're addressing an audience next time, regardless through what means, whether it's a presentation or you're writing a blog or even in an email, you have the clarity of your message. I call it the clarity of your 10%, simply because the brain after 48 hours forgets about 90% of what you share. So do you know the 10% that you want to leave in their minds?
So the goal is not so much to expand your memory, but to make sure that the 10% is there.
Exactly. You said it very well. Sometimes people are overly ambitious and they want others to remember a whole lot of things. I would say focus on fewer, but the right things.
Businesses use traditional media and print advertising to promote their services and products. Do you think this still is an effective way to convey your message, or you can see far better returns if you apply the same budget towards a different outlet?
It's usually a combination of media. The point is related to the previous question, which is, do you have the clarity of your message? And once you do, then make sure that you stay consistent with that message across various channels. So if you're giving a formal presentation, you want to make sure that customers remember one message. And then when you share some things via social media, that message doesn't change. And when you share it via an article, that message doesn't change. If you write a white paper, it's to support the same message. Because you never know how people get to that message. They may have various preferences. The mistake, since we're talking about mistakes earlier, is that sometimes that message changes, and we want to impress people with novelty so much and with variety that we forget that at some point your 10% message should not change. That is one unifying value across all of these various channels. So, for example, I was reading the message from one company that was promising their customers to, if they were buying its products, to organize their life better. And in that situation, they were doing it by buying a specific kind of bookshelves, organizers that you can use in your office. If you've seen those concepts from California closets, it would be the equivalent for that, but for the office. And organize your life was their main message. And all sorts of campaigns across all sorts of media became focused on that one message. And after a while, they switched. They went from organize your life better to put more efficiency in your life. So see, suddenly we're going from one promise to another promise. And now if people are hearing inconsistent messages, they don't know which one to believe. And if you hear from a source, by the way, a message consistently, and that message does not change, the brain equates consistency with validity. So that's why, regardless of your media, there isn't one media that inherently is more memorable than another. Just make sure that once you pick your message, you stay consistent across the board, and people are more likely to believe that it's true if they hear it unchanged from various channels.
We keep hearing that society is getting a shorter attention span. Do you agree with that?
No, that's not true. And it's one thing that we can debunk by looking at brain science in general. It's a shame that people tend to share this finding that says that human beings have the attention span of a goldfish. And I've seen that spread, speaking of social media, across all sorts of channels. It's not true. The brain has not changed much in the past 40,000 years. we are capable of prolonged periods of attention. If you have watched movies such as Avatar or The Martian, then you know that you're capable of paying attention for at least 3 hours, which is how long those movies are. Very few people get up to make a sandwich during those movies. There may be exceptions, but typically you stay and you watch. So we know it's possible. Unfortunately, though, what has changed lately is not that our attention span is shorter, but that our threshold for stimulation has changed. In other words, unless we're stimulated more and more frequently in shorter and shorter periods of time, then we become unsettled. I was listening to someone talk the other day, and he was saying that he suffered so much because he was on an airplane ride from one coast to the other here in the U.S., and the entertainment system was down, and his devices were not charged. So for 5 hours, he had to actually sit there and listen to his thoughts, and that became very uncomfortable and very boring very soon. So as a society, we're starting to create this just constant craving of stimulation in the brain.
So how do we measure the threshold of a stimulation? Does that vary from person to person?
It's many of these principles that I'm sharing are transcending gender and demographics in general, simply because they are related to some basic functions that that the brain has. The brain is constantly on the search for the next thing that that happens, simply because in terms of survival, we have to predict what happens next. And we enjoy familiarity on one hand, just simply because if we're familiar with things, then we know how to predict the next moment. But we also, at the same time, enjoy novelty because this is how we learn how to do better next time. So given the rhythm between these two things, something that's familiar and something that is new, of course we will pay attention, and then we will stay there regardless if you're from China or from California, or if you're 20 years old or 6 years old, some of these functions are going to be similar. Now, where we differ, however, is when I say that the brain enjoys familiarity, what's familiar to a 20-year-old brain may not necessarily be so familiar to a 60-year-old brain, and vice versa. So when you hear in business content the adage, know your audience, I would change that to, from a brain science perspective, to know your audience's habits. Because then you are more likely to create content that fits within an existing mental model that the brain has, and you're not asking people to work too hard. Therefore, attention is already granted. We have an expanded attention for that which you already know. Like if you ever buy a new car, do you ever buy a car and suddenly everybody on the highway drives the same car that you bought? It's not like all of a sudden there are more of those cars, but your attention has expanded for that which you already know. So if you want to go around this myth of, oh, our attention span is so much shorter, feed into existing models for which attention is already guaranteed.
So you mentioned about Hollywood and movies regarding to attention span. Even though with some special effects and some mind-blowing animation, some of these still fail. It doesn't translate to the public. How much do you think that has anything to do with stimulation or something more related to the narrative and the storytelling?
Ooh, now that we're bringing storytelling into the picture, that's another branch altogether. We can debunk some myths too from a brain science perspective where storytelling is concerned, because somehow people believe that simply sharing a story guarantees memory, and that's not true also. It's not true because we forget stories like we forget anything else. If you think for your own situation, you've been hearing a lot of stories since last week. If you're living and breathing, you're hearing tons of stories every day to the point where we're almost drowning in stories. And stories have become almost like a buzzword. And I just recently did a study where I set forth to do exactly just that, find out if stories are really what we remember. And we forget stories so quickly. Reflecting on the stories you've been hearing since last week, how many stories do you really remember accurately? Since, let's just say, last Thursday, I would guarantee that only a few, if you're lucky, have managed to stay on your mind. I'm thinking for my own situation. I just came back from a European trip. And during that trip, I took a one-day tour from one country to another. And that guide was very experienced and a very good storyteller. And out of the 12 hours that we spent together, she must have shared maybe on average at least 15 stories. And if somebody sat me down and they said, how many stories do you really remember from that tour? I would be lucky if I remember two or three with a few details. So if we get stories, so that means that as a business communicator, you have a responsibility to think, even for stories, you have to work a little bit harder in order to make those memorable. So for movies, if we're saying what keeps us in there, is it like a lot of stimulation, a lot of variety from one scene to the next? Is it the story overall? It's most likely a combination, because you might have the most amazing story, but if things don't progress fairly quickly across a timeline, then the brain gets bored very fast. For example, if you ever watch some of those independent movies, do you ever watch those?
Yes.
That might break some mental models that we have in terms of how quickly things progress and how fast a character develops or something else happens. There are some, I was just watching one not too long ago where this person was seen eating soup in the same amount of time that would take you in real life to eat soup. So imagine after second 20 or after 30 seconds or so, you're ready for something else to happen if you're a patient person, because usually we're expecting things to change every few seconds. And yet some of those independent artists and directors are messing with some of our existing mental models. So you have to be careful, because where the brain is concerned, it will want some variety, because it craves more and more stimulation in shorter and shorter segments with a lot more motion too in those segments. But at the same time, you as a business communicator, unlike Hollywood, have to make sure that beyond all of that variety that you're giving to the brain and the narrative of it all, you're staying in charge of a message that you want them to take away. Because otherwise, the danger is, and if you're providing the brain a lot of stimulation and a lot of variety, after an hour or so, it will have felt entertained throughout and engaged throughout that entire psychological sequence, but you're not in charge of what they may take away.
I see. You also highlight three key elements. I believe it's attention trigger, memory magnets, and decision drivers. Could you give us an example of each one of those?
Yeah, usually I start with those three pillars simply because I'm explaining to business communicators this. As you're reflecting on your own content, you want to make sure that you're memorable. You want to make sure that you're controlling your 10%. You're in charge of a message that you want to put on people's minds. Quite often, the reason why people don't remember that message is because they don't pay attention to begin with. There's just so much that's vying for our attention these days that a lot of things are competing for. Therefore, we have to have different skills in order to even attract people's attention. So attention paves the way to memory, which memory paves the way to decision making. So it's those three pillars, attention, memory, and decision, that have to be in the arsenal of any modern business presenter. So if we were to look at some guidelines that we attach to each, let's take attention, for instance. Just a few moments ago, we were talking about existing mental models. You normally advocate to people to hook their new content into something that already exists in people's brains so that they find it easier to pay attention to something naturally. So for example, let's just say that you are the inventor of a new piece of software. And you have a choice. You can start that piece of software from scratch, or you can integrate it with an existing software that people already have a mental model for. Let's just say Salesforce. Everybody in this world knows about Salesforce. I was just working with this client the other day, and what they did very well is that they didn't start from scratch with their software. They integrated with Salesforce. So when they go in to pitch their product, they don't say, hey, here's a new thing that does this and that and the other. They say, do you use Salesforce? And it's a lot easier for them to sell, because the brain already has a mental model for something. So it's easier to pay attention naturally to that which already exists.
I was going to say, there's already an open dialogue there.
Exactly. You have an open dialogue, and the brain already knows what to do with the rest of the information. It has something to fit it in. However, you can insist on familiarity too much because the brain after a while habituates. So if I'm giving you too much of what you already know, after a while you get bored and you're seeking some other stimulus. So as a communicator, where attention is concerned, that first pillar that you mentioned, you are in charge and you must be a choreographer of something that feels familiar to the brain and something that's slightly a twist at some point. So for example, I was impressed with what this bookstore did in Israel. They were advertising their bookstore, and obviously, just as like any bookstore, what do they want? They want people to walk into the store and buy books. So their advertising became, if you picture the Facebook logo, which is the blue background and the white text on top of it, Facebook, they very cleverly inserted an A inside that word. So now it says face a book. So see, you're giving the brain something that it recognizes, a familiar mental model, which is the Facebook iconic logo by now, but twisted slightly with just the insertion of one letter. So now you're playing off of the familiar. So that would be a guideline that I would advocate for attention. For memory, I would say make sure that once you clarify your 10% message, so you know exactly what you want to put in people's minds, that message also comes to mind easily. So it's marked by cognitive ease. Because sometimes people have the clarity of a message, but it's expressed in such a convoluted way that maybe it comes to your mind easily just because you're used to your own messages, but not to somebody else's. Like, for instance, I was reading an article the other day, and they were talking about the new McLaren. Are you into cars at all?
Yes, indeed. The new McLaren.
There you go. So you might know about the 570S sport model. And this author was reflecting on its dihedral doors, which apparently have this on this new model. They have this very technologically advanced way of opening these doors, so such that when they go up and down, they inject some air into the radiators. And they were saying that if you want to insult a McLaren owner, you would say that these are Lamborghini doors. They're not. They're very much different. So by using that phrase, the dihedral doors, I was thinking, boy, that's just such a fancy way of calling these doors. But I don't know if that phrase would be coming to somebody else's mind easily unless they were an expert in this field. So make sure that your message is marked by cognitive ease in the sense of create messages that come to the brain easily, because the brain is a cognitively lazy organ. It doesn't want to think so hard about stuff that it finds useful in the future. And for decision drivers, so we talked about attention, we talked about memory. If we want to push the brain just in a little extra way, make sure that you give it enough contrast. This is a new book that I'm working on, and I'm noticing that contrast is a shortcut to decision making. Anytime you give the brain a very sharp contrast saying, this is what you're doing right now, but this is what you could be doing, or the situation is like this, but it could be a little bit different, then you're pushing it or giving it just a little tiny nudge. And contrast is preferred by the brain because it already has that cognitive ease. Do you remember the times where the Palm Trio was really popular? This is like way back. There's an ad that I still remember from that campaign, which was marked by contrast. So if you imagine a page that was divided into two columns, on the column to the left, you had this hand on somebody, and somebody had written on their hand all sorts of notes and things that were important, and phone numbers and names and some other data. And it was just all so messy and disorganized. And on the other hand, you had this tiny little, very clear and sensuous looking trio, the palm. And the contrast was just so sharp. You would go from something that's chaotic and temporary to something that is stable and simple and sophisticated. So give the brain some contrast, and you're going to push it towards a decision a lot more easily.
Let me circle back regarding the McLaren that you, the story you're just telling me. Wouldn't it be like the case that perhaps they're marketing to their niche in terms of someone who spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or close to $1 million in a car? It's more of a car aficionado. So that term maybe is familiarity to their niche, but not so much to the general public. Could that be the case as well?
Exactly. So that's why we were saying earlier, when you're looking at the phrase know your audience, I would say know your audience's habits or existing mental models. Because unless your audiences are already speaking your vocabulary, you're not giving them cognitive ease. For instance, we were working with a client the other day and they were saying, oh, our 10% message, which I usually prompt people, what's your 10% message? And they're saying our 10% message is that our technology is modularly versatile. And I was thinking, there's just no way that phrase comes to other people's minds after they were, have heard it once or twice, because it's just, it's not inherently marked by cognitive ease. So unless you are one of these aficionados in technology or in cars or in whatever field you're operating, then you're not respectful enough of how little mental energy the brain wants to expand toward recollecting your message.
How much are we truly in control of our decisions?
If left to its own devices, the brain prefers indulging habits, simply because once you have formed a habit, then you don't have to expand too much cognitive energy. Once you start taking the same route to work, once you start wearing the certain type of clothes, once you start eating in a certain way, it's just so difficult to change. So, of course, you prefer these automatic behaviors simply because they help the brain conserve cognitive energy. You see, the only reason why we have a brain is so that we can move. And in the movement that the brain helps us make, it consumes a lot of our body's energy. So this is why anytime the brain finds an occasion to conserve it, it will take it. This is why people fall asleep in presentations, for instance. So of course we love to indulge our habits, because what is a habit but a memorized algorithm that gets you to a reward a lot faster? And as long as habits are keeping you rewarded, then there is no damage in indulging them. Unfortunately, we also tend to engage in habits that are detrimental to our survival. So that's when we have to bring decisions more into the conscious kind of realm and really think and be deliberate and apply some willpower to what we want to do next.
As consumers, we're moving a lot of our purchases online, and we companies like Amazon and many others being able to capitalize in a lot of information that goes back to patents. Do you fear that some of those information can be misused in this misplaced, or you mostly as an opportunity to study that data and see how they can better serve their clients?
Yeah, you mean in terms of people monitoring your online behaviors and then targeting some advertisements? Alongside those.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of businesses wanted to capitalize on that as well. As they know you spend more and more time on that media, they want to find out how they can be in front of you and kind of have an idea of your thought process, right?
Yeah, so it depends from whose point of view we are analyzing the situation. If we're analyzing it from the marketer's point of view, of course it makes perfect sense, because if you can attach your products or your services to people's existing habits, you're going to have an easier time selling, period. And as long as you're applying it for ethical purposes, in the sense of what you're selling serves you as a company and them, the customers, well, then everybody wins. So as long as you go in with ethical principles, then no harm done. Now, from the consumer's perspective, that's a little bit more challenging, because for instance, let's just say that I take a break from work. I might go to a website and I love looking at shoes. And there is a pair that I really like, but I decide that, oh, shoot, it's a little bit expensive. So I decide not to buy it. And I'll be darned if I'm now in the middle of a work project. And what do I see on the right-hand side as I'm doing some research online? Well, there are their shoes and they're following me. And I see them today and then the next day and then the next day after that. I just can't get rid of those shoes, even though my willpower was there 3 days ago. now I'm more likely to indulge simply because those things are top of mind. This is how we started our interview, see? Memory is the business of all business success. So those people manage to stay on top of mind again and again and again. So as consumers, we're going to find some different techniques to make sure that we don't indulge as much as we could.
They want to make seamless. So you think it was meant to be instead of designed that way?
Well, you want to find some different techniques, and if you know that those things are starting to pop up, there are some ways in which you as a consumer can start blocking them, but you're going to have to protect yourself a little bit more, knowing that your willpower is going to now be taxed that much more.
One of your talks, you compare dopamine with the Kardashians. Can you tell me why?
Yes. Obviously, there are a lot of neurotransmitters that we have in our brains, and by neurotransmitters, I mean the chemicals that are being released as neurons communicate with each other. And one such neurotransmitter is dopamine. And out of all the neurotransmitters, dopamine has been so popular and so overly talked about that we're calling it the Kim Kardashian of neurotransmitters.
What is a common misconception with dopamine?
We used to believe as neuroscientists that dopamine was simply linked to something that you liked and you craved. Like, give me some example of something that you like and crave.
I don't know. Let's say cheesecake.
Imagine when you indulge in that that cheesecake, you also benefit of the release of that chemical in your brain, and that activates your reward centers, and oh, the whole thing feels just so pleasurable. But the newer finding is that you don't have to have dopamine in your brain in order to like and crave cheesecake. You have to have dopamine in your brain to go get it. So the more recent findings are correlating the presence of that chemical in your brain with your ability to act on something and have enough drive to go and do something about a specific concept. So for customers and for communicators, this concept is important, because if you want people to move towards you, which is the only reason why they have a brain, if you want to convince customers to come and get your product or your services, that means you have to find ways in which that chemical is activated enough so that they have enough drive to expand that energy in your favor.
So there's a level of anticipation. And maybe that's why hundreds of people will spend the night outside an Apple store waiting to buy the latest iPhone.
Yeah, one such way to create anticipation, to create dopamine, there are many ways, but one way to increase the level of dopamine in your brain is to create anticipation towards something. This is why if you've ever spent time preparing for the trip that you're going to take, that time of preparation and anticipation is quite often more enticing than the trip itself. And that's because you have more of that dopamine dose in your brain. And you're enjoying it, and you have enough drive. If you ever think, how in the world did I stay up all night to prepare and pack and have all sorts of plans? It's because that dopamine is high enough in your brain that it fuels the energy to act.
That's good. What's new study and findings that you think is exciting that's going to be popping up soon enough for everybody to find out?
I'm very much right now into studying a lot more about how energy gets depleted and then replenished in the brain. So I think the next phase in us finding guidelines that we can then share with communicators will be, how do you manage cognitive energy in your audience's brains?
And how long it takes at one point from the research to not become mainstream, but actually being able to communicate to other people that this is the new finds?
It depends. It can range from a few months to a few years. It depends on the complexity of what you're studying and how many people are involved and what it takes to get a study approved and carry through. I mean, imagine when you're studying the human brain, especially if you're taking it at a neuroscientific level, which means you're really peeking underneath the human skull to understand what does what, then you have to expand at least a few weeks, if not more, just simply to get approval in order to carry some of those studies. Luckily, though, some of the technology these days is not that intrusive, and some consent can happen fairly quickly. For instance, I'm starting to specialize a lot more in EEG studies, and you may have seen those EEG headsets, which you can place on somebody's scalp. And you can have anywhere between 14 electrodes to 128 or more. And those electrodes will monitor the brain waves that are happening as the brain is exposed to stimulation. So for those studies, you don't have to have as much involvement in the sense of getting approval and carrying it through and extracting some results. So that could be perhaps a month or less. But beyond that, you can it could take some time. It's exciting, though, because the technology advances so quickly and people are getting so excited to participate and to contribute to science, that I think exponentially we're going to see a lot more of these findings. Imagine, just like in the past two decades, we have found more about the brain than in the whole mankind combined. How much more of these is going to happen in the upcoming years? It's a very exciting field to be.
And it goes beyond just, I guess, the marketing aspect and how the consumer base as well. I think VR is going to be a big changer as it becomes more available for everybody, not only for entertainment, but also for treatment.
Exactly. And the caution that we have to have, though, as scientists, is not to overdo it, because sometimes we might put so much energy and money into a neuroscience-based study, but then we find things that are just so obvious. Like, for instance, I was reading about this study, an fMRI study that was focused on PTSD, you know, the post-traumatic stress disorder. And the conclusion for that study was that PTSD is a great source of human suffering. And I'm reading this, I'm thinking, seriously, you had to spend a few million dollars in order to find out that PTSD is a great source of human suffering? So make sure that for anyone who's listening and who does have the funds to undergo some of these neuroscience-based studies, you use it for things that are not obvious and are fairly exciting and warrant the use of that type of technology.
So what else have you been working on lately?
I'm very excited about the EEG studies. The EEG technology has gotten so mobile lately and so fairly easy to use. Obviously, the technology is easy to use. What's not so easy is the interpretation of those brain waves that you're monitoring. But for us, that's the new wave in terms of getting to notice what happens in the brain when the brain is exposed to stimulation, and finding correlations between those brain waves and people's memories 48 hours after exposure to that stimulation.
Is there any new book coming up soon?
Yes, I'm working on a few. There's one that I'm excited about, and it's on contrast, since we were talking about that concept a little bit earlier. I believe that out of all the paths to decision-making, contrast is one of the shortest and the easiest for the brain, and the brain being a cognitively lazy organ, it enjoys shortcuts to almost anything. So I'm looking at ways in which we can communicate so we can create contrast so people can make decisions faster.
I want to thank you for taking the time. This has been amazing. But now tell everybody how they can find out more about you, your work, and everything else.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And if you're intrigued by what helps us stay on people's brains and create memories that then impact decisions, you can find us at memzy.com, M-E-M-Z-Y. And it will be great to stay in touch and to see how you can convince people's brains to move in your favor.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Carmen Simon, thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Hey everyone, make sure to like, comment, and let us know what you think. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.